So this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. And look, if you're gearing up for your exams, I mean, they have a full Series 99 course. It's loaded with, you know, adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, unlimited practice exams.
Yeah, and they're weighted exactly like the real thing, which is huge.
Right. Exactly. So you can check all of that out over at CertFuel.com.
For sure.
But, okay, let's just jump right in. Imagine you walk into a brokerage firm, right? You hand over literally your entire life savings to be invested.
Okay.
And, you know, you go to sleep feeling great, like, I made the smart financial move.
Right, you're responsible.
Yeah, exactly. But overnight, that brokerage firm makes just a catastrophic series of bets. They lever themselves into oblivion, and boom, they file for bankruptcy.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so tomorrow morning, when the landlord and, you know, the creditors come knocking to collect on the firm's debts, does your money just vanish to pay them off? I mean, that's the nightmare, right? So today's deep dive is really about the exact, you know, invisible legal walls keeping your money safe. We are pulling directly from the FINRA rulebook, SEC regulatory filings, and study guides focused entirely on function one of the Series 99 exam.
Yeah. And I mean, we are getting into the absolute core of the financial plumbing today.
Oh, yeah.
For anyone listening who is preparing to sit for that exam, function one is it's not just a minor hurdle. It represents 70% of your entire test.
Wow.
Yeah, 70%. That is 35 scored items.
Just on this one function.
Just on this one. I mean, if you do not intimately understand the rules of custody, safekeeping, and control, there is frankly no mathematical way to pass.
Right. I mean, it's the whole ballgame.
Yeah.
But regulatory text, especially, you know, SEC and FINRA rulebooks, is historically just so dry.
Oh, it's brutal.
It's like eating saltine crackers in a desert. So to make sure this actually, like, sticks in your brain, especially for those of us who, you know, maybe zone out during dry lectures.
Right. The ADHD crowd, we see you.
Exactly. We are going to map these rules out using a few recurring characters today, kind of creating a tiny, highly regulated cinematic universe just to see how these rules break down in reality.
I love that. I love a good scenario. So who are the players in our little universe here?
Okay, so first we have Nervous Nancy.
Okay, Nervous Nancy.
She is the everyday retail customer. She worked her entire life to build up her nest egg. You know, she just wants her assets protected, and she is rightfully paranoid that some guy in a suit is going to lose all her money.
And honestly, her paranoia is the exact reason the Securities and Exchange Commission exists in the first place.
Totally. So enter character number two, Careless Carl.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Carl is the well-meaning but completely disastrous broker-dealer operations guy.
Gotcha.
He manages the back office. He means no harm, right? But he is literally a walking, breathing compliance violation.
Oh, I know guys like this.
Right. Like, if a regulatory rule can be broken by, I don't know, spilling an iced coffee on a keyboard, Careless Carl's going to find a way to do it.
Yeah. The industry is full of Careless Carls, honestly, which makes him sort of the perfect stress test for the regulations we're covering today.
Exactly. And finally, character number three, Frank the Founder.
Ah, Frank.
Yeah. He's a corporate insider.
Yeah.
A major affiliate of a publicly traded company. He walks around in like a fleece vest in July, drinks artisanal matcha, and genuinely believes the rules of, you know, financial gravity just simply do not apply to him.
A fantastic trio. I can already picture them.
Right. So to set the stage for function one, we really need to begin with Nancy as biggest fear. She walks into Careless Carl's brokerage firm. She deposits her life savings, and she wants to know how Carl's going to keep it safe from his own incompetence.
Which is very fair of her.
Right. And this introduces the two most fundamental defensive concepts in all of customer asset protection, safekeeping and segregation.
Yes.
And the exam will absolutely test your ability to distinguish between these two because, I mean, they sound like synonyms, right?
They do, yeah. To an outsider, they sound exactly the same.
But they serve entirely different legal and physical purposes.
Absolutely.
So I always think of it this way, and you correct me if I'm off here. Mm-hmm. Safekeeping is the physical fortress.
Mm-hmm.
It has the locked vault, the security cameras, the, you know, 6-inch steel door, biometric scanners. It is the protection of Nancy's assets against physical loss or theft or just damage.
Right.
Safekeeping basically ensures Carl can't just leave her actual stock certificates on the subway or accidentally run them through a paper shredder.
Exactly. But safekeeping alone is wildly insufficient.
Really? Why?
Well, let's say Carl's firm has the best vault in the world, right? Nobody can break in.
Okay.
But then Carl's firm takes out massive loans, loses a fortune in the market, and goes bankrupt.
Right.
So the creditors show up with a court order. They open that impenetrable vault and say, great, look at all these assets we can seize to pay off Carl's debts.
Oh, wow. So safekeeping did not save Nancy in that scenario at all.
Not even a little bit. Mm-hmm. And that is exactly where segregation steps in.
Okay, so segregation is the legal barrier.
Yes.
If the vault is safekeeping, segregation is having a perfectly labeled, completely separate, just untouchable customer compartment inside that vault.
Exactly. It functions as a strict legal and accounting wall. Segregation requires the broker-dealer to keep customer securities entirely separate from the firm's proprietary securities.
Wait, proprietary just means the firm's own money, right?
Right, yeah. The broker-dealer's own assets. So under bankruptcy law, if Carl's firm collapses, segregation guarantees that the bankruptcy trustee looks at Nancy's compartment and says, this does not belong to the firm. It belongs to Nancy. General creditors cannot touch this.
Oh, okay. So it's basically the difference between protecting the asset from a burglar, which is safekeeping, and protecting the asset from a judge, which is segregation.
That is a perfect way to remember it for the test, burglar versus judge.
Nice. But okay, the regulators use a third word that seems to trip people up constantly, and that's control. Because the rules dictate a broker dealer has to, quote, promptly obtain and maintain physical possession or control of fully paid and excess margin securities.
Right.
So let me ask you this. If I'm Carl and I take Nancy's stock certificates and lock them in a safety deposit box at my local Chase Bank branch, is that control? Because I have the key, right?
Yeah, having the key is not the legal definition of control.
No, it's not.
No, not at all. The SEC and FINRA define control as a very specific, recognized legal status.
Oh, right.
It's tied to approved locations and strict conditions.
Okay.
Physical possession is pretty straightforward. You know, Carl has the paper certificates in his vault, or maybe they are actively in transit between the firm's approved offices. But control means the assets are sitting at a recognized, highly regulated third-party location.
Okay, give me an example of an approved location then, because my safety deposit box theory clearly just completely failed the exam.
Right. Well, you would need to use something like a clearing corporation or an organization that's a subsidiary of a national securities exchange or a custodian bank that utilizes a central handling system.
Oh, so it has to be official.
Extremely official.
Yeah.
The regulators need to know that the entity holding the assets is playing by the exact same strict rule book as the broker dealer.
Gotcha.
But, and the exam loves to lay a trap right here, simply dumping the assets at a custodian bank does not automatically grant Carl control status.
Okay, listeners, this is a critical moment where the exam loves to lay a trap. If you are taking notes, circle this. What is the gotcha condition for a control location?
There are actually two massive conditions. First, the delivery of the assets to the broker-dealer must require no payment of money or value.
Meaning what?
It has to be a free delivery mechanism. The custodian can't say, sure, we'll give you your assets back, but you owe us 50 grand first.
Okay. That makes sense. What's the second condition?
Second, the broker-dealer's books and records must explicitly identify the customers entitled to specified quantities or units.
So Carl can't just point to a giant, unorganized pile of stocks at a clearing corporation and tell the auditors, yeah, you know, some of those in the middle belong to Nancy.
Exactly. The books have to specifically state, Nervous Nancy owns 500 shares of this exact stock held at this exact location. It goes right back to segregation. The labeling must be flawless.
Okay, that brings us to another highly tested control location, which is the Omnibus Credit Account.
Oh, yes. The Omnibus account.
Yeah, so let me set up the Omnibus scenario because this involves how broker-dealers talk to each other.
Okay, go for it.
Let's say Carolus Carlther's firm is really small. They are what's called an introducing broker. They don't have their own massive, expensive vault or clearing infrastructure.
Right, which is very common.
Yeah, so they hire a giant Wall Street mega bank carrying broker-dealer to actually hold the assets and execute the trades. Carl's firm essentially dumps all their customer assets into one giant bucket at the mega bank. That giant bucket is an omnibus account, and it complies with Regulation T, which governs the extension of credit by brokers.
Exactly. And using a carrying broker is standard practice. But Carl cannot just open the omnibus account, dump Nancy's assets in, and walk away.
He can't.
No. To maintain legal control of those assets while they sit at the mega bank, Carl's firm must issue strict written instructions to that carrying broker.
What kind of instructions?
You will see this specific phrasing tested. The caring firm must be instructed to maintain possession or control free of any charge, lien, or claim of any kind in favor of that caring firm.
Okay, let me put that in plain English. Carl has to explicitly tell the megabank, hey, this bucket is full of my customer's assets.
Mm-hmm.
If my firm owes you money or like if we miss a margin call, you cannot put a lien on Nancy's shares to cover my debt.
Exactly. It prevents the megabank from holding Nancy's assets hostage for Carl's mistakes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it preserves that segregation wall we talked about, even when the assets are stored miles away at a secondary location.
That makes total sense. But let's pause for a second and think about how this actually looks on paper. Because if Nancy buys 500 shares of a massive tech company through Carl's firm, the tech company doesn't, like, mail her a piece of paper with Nervous Nancy, beautifully written in calligraphy on it.
They do not. The modern market just moves way too fast for that, which introduces a really important concept, street name versus beneficial owner.
Okay, listener, take a second and really think about this question, whether you're at the gym or driving right now. If Nancy's shares are held in street name, whose name is actually physically registered on the stock certificate or the tech company's master ledger,
give them a beat to think.
Got an answer. The name registered on the books is Carl Hira's firm.
Yep.
The broker-dealer, or maybe a nominee name they use, is not Nancy's name.
And honestly, this often panics retail investors when they first learn about it. They look at the paperwork and go, wait, why does the firm own my stock?
Right, where's my name?
But it is a completely necessary feature of market liquidity. Having Carl's firm registered on the certificate does not make Carl the economic owner. Nancy remains what is legally called the beneficial owner.
Meaning she reaps all the actual benefits?
All of them. She gets the quarterly dividends. She gets the proxy voting rights for the board of directors.
Oh, she still gets to vote.
Absolutely. And she captures the capital gains when the stock goes up.
Okay.
You know, holding securities in street name actually solved the Wall Street paperwork crisis of the late 1960s.
Oh, I've heard of this.
Yeah. Back then, trading volume spiked and firms were literally physically exchanging paper certificates for every trade. The market actually had to close early on Wednesdays just to let the back office clerks catch up on the mountains of paperwork.
That is insane. Just closing down the stock market so people could sort paper.
Right. So street name fixed that. It allows Carl's firm to transfer shares electronically with other firms without having to track Nancy down to get her physical notarized signature every single time she wants to sell a single share.
Okay, so the vault is technically in Carl's name, but every bit of economic value inside Nancy's segregated compartment flows directly to her.
Exactly.
Now, how does that differ from buying a mutual fund directly? Because I know mutual funds operate on slightly different plumbing.
Good distinction. Direct mutual fund investments often utilize customer name registration rather than street name.
Oh.
So if Nancy buys directly into a mutual fund family, the shares are registered directly on the mutual fund's own transfer agent books in Nancy's actual name.
Gotcha. So the exam might ask you to identify the difference between customer name registration, which is direct, and street name registration, which utilizes the broker-dealer as the name holder for efficiency.
Precisely.
Okay, so Nancy's assets are locked up, they're segregated, and they're tracked. But careless Carl is sitting in his back office, right? And he's staring at the ledger.
Uh-oh.
He sees millions of dollars in street name shares just sitting there doing nothing. And Carl realizes that Wall Street makes a fortune by lending things out.
This is where the trouble starts.
Right, because short sellers constantly need to borrow shares so they can sell them, hoping to buy them back cheaper later. So Carl thinks, well, why don't I just lend out Nancy's shares to a hedge fund and make a little extra yield for my firm?
And this brings us right into the compliance minefield of loaning and borrowing. This is where a broker-dealer can completely destroy itself if it fails to follow the authorization rules.
So what's the rule?
Well, the golden rule of lending customer securities depends entirely on how the customer paid for them in the first place.
Okay, break that down.
Let's start with margin securities. If Nancy has a margin account, meaning she borrowed money from Carl's firm to buy more stock than she could afford with just her cash.
Right. She took out a loan.
Exactly. Yeah. Her securities are now acting as collateral for that loan. And because she owes the firm money, those margin securities might be eligible to be pledged or loaned out to other parties.
But Carl still can't just lend them out silently, right? Like, he can't just hide a tiny clause in a 50-page digital terms of service update and assume she's okay with it.
No, he cannot. To lend eligible margin securities, Carl must have Nancy's explicit written authorization.
Written authorization, okay.
Now, in practice, this authorization is almost always signed the very moment the margin account is initially opened. It's just a standard part of the margin agreement.
Right, you just sign the stack of papers that covers margin.
Yeah.
But what if nervous Nancy is incredibly conservative?
Okay.
Like, she doesn't owe Carl a dime. She paid 100% cash for her shares. These are her fully paid securities. Or, you know, maybe she has a margin account, but she has massive amounts of excess margin, meaning the value of her stock is vastly higher than the tiny loan she took out. Can Carl still lend those out?
The regulatory walls around fully paid and excess margin securities are incredibly thick.
I would hope so.
Yeah. We established earlier that the firm has a strict duty to maintain possession or control of these specific assets, right?
Right.
However, Carl can actually borrow Nancy's fully paid securities, provided he satisfies a very rigorous set of conditions so he doesn't violate that possession duty.
Wow. Okay, I'm assuming condition number one is paperwork, and knowing the regulator's timing is probably everything.
You guessed it.
Like, Carl can't borrow the shares on Tuesday, lend them to a short seller, and then beg Nancy to sign a backdated form on Friday.
No, timing is absolute. Carl's firm and Nancy must enter into a specific written agreement at or before the loan occurs. Not after, not during, at or before.
But here is where the regulations force Carl to be brutally honest with Nancy. And this is another prime exam target, folks, regarding the required written disclosures.
Oh yeah, pay attention to this.
Before Carl makes his very first borrow of fully paid or excess margin securities from Nancy, he has to hand her a written warning that outlines two incredibly sobering risks.
It is essentially a document telling the customer everything that could ruin them financially if this transaction goes poorly.
Listener, try to recall this from your studying. I'm going to ask you right now. What are the two specific risks Carl is legally forced to warn Nancy about before he borrows her fully paid shares?
Give him a second.
Think about the safety nets we normally rely on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the first massive warning is about SIPC, the Securities Investor Protection Corporation. Carl has to tell her that the Securities Investor Protection Act, SIPA, may not protect her for this loan transaction.
And that is a terrifying reality for a retail investor.
Yeah, that's huge.
Because SIPC is the insurance fund that protects customers if their broker-dealer fails.
Right.
It replaces missing stocks and cash up to certain limits. But the moment Nancy signs that agreement and lends her fully paid shares to Carl, she fundamentally changes her legal relationship with the firm.
How so?
She is no longer just a protected customer. She becomes a lender, a general creditor. By loaning the shares, she steps entirely outside of the standard SIPA protection umbrella for that specific transaction.
Which cascades directly into the second required warning. If SIPC won't save her, what will? So risk number two. Carl must warn her that the collateral he provides her for the loan may be her only source of recovery if his firm goes belly up and fails to return her shares.
Exactly. When Carl borrows the shares, he has to give Nancy collateral, usually cash or U.S. treasuries, to hold on to.
Right.
If Carl lends the shares to a hedge fund, the hedge fund blows up. Carl's firm defaults and the shares are just gone. Nancy cannot go crying to SIPC to make her whole. She has to seize the collateral she is holding.
And if she accepted collateral that fluctuated in value, like, and it suddenly dropped?
She absorbs that total loss.
Man. So to recap Carl's greed here, written agreement at or before the loan, and strict written disclosures warning about the loss of SIPA protection and reliance on collateral before the very first borrow, do not let the exam flip the timing of those requirements.
Good advice. Moving forward, though, I mean, it's wonderful that these rules exist on paper, but regulations are meaningless without enforcement.
Very true.
So how do the regulators actually prove that Careless Carl possesses the securities his digital ledger claims he has?
It's audit time.
It's audit time.
The regulators are knocking on the door. Carl is probably sweating through his shirt. He needs to prove his books aren't a work of fiction.
Oh.
This brings us to the box count.
Right. Formerly known in the rules as a securities count. Broker dealers, subject to this rule, must conduct a rigorous periodic accounting. And the first step is highly literal. They must physically examine and count all securities they hold in their physical possession.
Just going into the vault and counting pieces of paper.
Exactly. And this includes securities that are the subject of repurchase or reverse repurchase agreements.
Okay, let's quickly define a repurchase agreement or repo for those who need a refresher.
Sure.
It's essentially a short-term secured loan, right? Carl sells the security to someone else with a strict promise to buy it back tomorrow at a slightly higher price. Mm. And the difference in price is basically the interest rate.
That's right.
So even though the security is temporarily moving around for financing, Carl still has to account for it in this count.
Exactly. It must be tracked. But the physical paper in the vault is really only half the battle. What about the billions of dollars of assets that aren't physically sitting in Carl's back office?
Right. The stuff at the mega bank.
Right. The rules dictate the firm must account for securities not in their physical possession by comparing their detailed records with their ledger control accounts. They must verify all securities out of their possession, meaning assets, sitting at a clearing depository or a custodian bank.
So they compare the physical count and the external verifications against their own internal stock ledger.
Yes.
And knowing Carl, there are going to be mistakes. What happens when the numbers just don't match?
The firm must record each unresolved difference in a specific ledger called a security count difference account.
A difference account. That sounds like a very polite way of saying that we lost millions of dollars account.
Basically.
It's just where you park the errors you haven't figured out yet.
Yeah.
But the exam loves to test the human element of this process. So let's play out a scenario.
Okay.
Careless Carl is the manager of the vault. He's the guy who logs the physical certificates in and out every single day.
Okay.
Can Carl be the guy who conducts the official quarterly box count of his own vault?
Absolutely not. Allowing that would violate the independence rule, which is designed to eliminate massive conflicts of interest.
Right, because you cannot grade your own homework.
Yeah.
I mean, if I lost $1 million of Nancy's stock and I am the one doing the audit, I am just going to write everything looks perfect on my clipboard to save my job.
Precisely why the SEC forbids it. The rule states that the count must be made or supervised by individuals whose regular duties give them absolutely no direct responsibility for caring for those securities or for making and keeping the records being tested. Huh. The counter must be entirely independent of the department being counted.
Gotcha. Let's do a side-by-side comparison on terminology here, because test takers often blur box count and verification, and they are different.
They are very different. A box count is the actual periodic physical counting of paper certificates held in the broker-dealer's physical custody. It is a tactile, hands-on audit.
Right. But the trap is that just counting the paper isn't the whole job.
Yep.
You can't just walk out of the vault and say, yep, there are exactly 5,000 pieces of paper in there, and call it a day. What must you do with that raw number?
The results of the physical count must be reconciled. They must be matched line by line with the firm's stock records, which is the master ledger, identifying exactly which customers are entitled to those specific securities.
Okay, so counting is step one. Reconciling against the books is step two. That's the box count. How does verification differ?
Verification applies exclusively to the positions that are away from the firm.
Oh, because you can't count them.
Right. You cannot walk into the depository trust company in New York and demand to physically count their vault. So you verify those external positions by taking your firm's stock records and comparing them against the official electronic records provided by that outside clearinghouse or custodian.
And what happens if Carl does his verification and his internal books say he should have 10,000 shares of Apple sitting at the custodian? But the custodian's records say, sorry, Carl, we only show 9,000 shares for your firm.
Mm-hmm.
Who is responsible for fixing that?
The regulatory standard is prompt joint resolution.
Joint resolution.
Yes. The broker-dealer and the outside organization must work together immediately to resolve the discrepancy. It is a shared, urgent responsibility to track down where that gap originated.
Okay, let's assume Carl miraculously survives the audit.
By some miracle.
Yeah. Nancy decides she wants to transfer some of her stock. Maybe she found a different broker, or maybe she just wants physical possession of a certificate to frame on her wall. It's time to move the assets.
Okay.
Which brings us to deliveries, transfers, and disasters. To understand what happens when Carl drops the ball, we first have to understand the standard for when things go right, which is the concept of good delivery.
Good delivery is a foundational market concept. It means a security is in perfect, proper form that permits the receiving party, whether that's the buyer or the new broker, to accept it and transfer it without any legal defects.
Clean paper.
Exactly. It's a clean, undisputed paper.
So if we are talking about a registered certificate, meaning Nancy's actual name is printed on the face of the document, what does good delivery require?
It requires several meticulous steps. First, it obviously needs the registered owner's name. Second, it requires a proper assignment or endorsement.
Like signing the back of a check.
Similar, but this is often executed using a separate legal document attached to the certificate called a stock power or bond power.
Oh, right. I think of a stock power as essentially a legally binding sticky note.
That's a good way to look at it.
Yeah, it says, I, Nancy, assign ownership of the attached certificate to this new person. It just allows you to transfer ownership without having to write directly on the historical certificate itself.
Exactly. Now, good delivery also requires a technically correct signature that perfectly matches the name exactly as it is printed on the certificate.
Meaning?
If it says Nancy M. Smith, she cannot sign it Nancy Smith. It has to be exact. And finally, it requires a guarantee that is acceptable to the transfer agent, which is almost always a medallion signature guarantee.
Let's unpack the medallion guarantee, because people often confuse it with a standard notary public.
Oh, yeah. They're not the same.
Right. If I go to a notary at the local shipping store, they check my driver's license, they stamp the paper, and they confirm I am who I say I am. Why isn't a $15 notary stamp good enough for Wall Street?
Because a notary stamp carries no financial backing whatsoever. A medallion signature guarantee is provided by a participating financial institution, like a major bank or broker-dealer.
Okay.
When that bank stamps the certificate with a medallion guarantee, they are not just verifying Nancy's identity. The bank is legally pledging their own assets to back that signature.
Whoa.
Yeah. If the signature turns out to be a forgery, the transfer agent can sue the bank that provided the medallion stamp to recover the lost funds. It is a massive financial insurance policy against fraud.
That makes total sense. The transfer agent won't move millions of dollars without a mega bank taking on the liability of the signature.
Precisely.
Now, that's for registered certificates. What about bearer certificates?
Bearer certificates are a completely different animal. They do not have a registered owner's name printed anywhere on them.
Oh, yeah.
They are payable literally to the bearer, whoever is physically holding the paper. Therefore, mere physical possession equals total transferability.
Which is wild to think about today. It's exactly like physical cash.
Yep.
Like, if you drop a $100 bill on the sidewalk,
yeah,
and I pick it up, it's my $100. If you drop a bearer bond, whoever finds it owns it.
That's exactly how it works.
This is why bearer bonds were the ultimate MacGuffin in every 1980s action movie, like Die Hard.
Right.
You could steal them, and they're completely untraceable.
Right. Hans Gruber loved a bearer bond.
Exactly. Which perfectly sets up our disaster scenario.
Okay, lay it on me.
Careless Carl is tasked with transporting a bearer certificate across the city. He is eating a hot dog, he trips, and he drops the certificate straight down a New York City sewer grate. It washes out to the Atlantic Ocean. It is gone forever.
Classic Carl.
That's scenario A. Now, scenario B, Carl is keeping the certificate in his office, and a highly trained international art thief drops from the ceiling vents, smashes the glass, and steals the certificate.
Okay. Mission Impossible style.
Listener, here is the exam trap.
Yeah.
Do these two radically different events, a clumsy accident versus a master criminal heist, get reported to different regulatory bodies?
Mm.
Think about the intent. Does the intent change the reporting requirement?
And the answer is absolutely no. Do not overthink this on the exam.
So whether it is a non-criminal loss in the sewer grate or a criminal theft by a cat burglar, the reporting institution reports the event to the exact same entities.
Yes. In both scenarios, the loss must be reported to the SEC, or its designee, and the registered transfer agent.
The exact same places.
The exact same places. The criminal nature of the event might change how the internal compliance team classifies it, or, you know, whether law enforcement is called. But the regulatory alert goes to the exact same places. Oh, and if Carl randomly discovers a counterfeit certificate in the vault, what happens then? That immediately gets reported to the SEC and the transfer agent as well.
Okay, I want to focus on why the transfer agent is alerted. The SEC makes sense. They're the cops.
Mm.
But the transfer agent is essentially the ultimate keeper of the corporate guest list,
right? That's a good way to phrase it, yeah.
They maintain the master ledger of all outstanding shares. If a piece of paper goes missing or is stolen, they need to know immediately so they can flag that specific certificate's serial number.
Exactly.
If the cat burglar tries to cash it in 6 months later, the transfer agent A system will reject it as stolen property.
That is the exact mechanical reason. They cancel the serial number. Now, while physical certificates and sewer grates make for great examples, the reality is that the modern financial system is overwhelmingly electronic.
Thank goodness.
Right. Which means test takers must understand the digital infrastructure, specifically two critical acronyms, DRS and DWS.
Let's do an analogy here, because otherwise this just sounds like alphabet soup.
Go for it.
DRS stands for the Direct Registration System. Think of DRS as the ultimate VIP guest list at an exclusive club.
Okay.
DRS permits securities to be registered directly in the investor's name on the issuer's electronic books. So Nancy's name is digitally written on the company's master guest list. She is established as the direct registered owner, and she never has to hold a physical paper certificate.
Right. DRS establishes the status of direct ownership.
Exactly. Now, DOAC, deposit withdrawal at custodian. If DRS is the guest list, DOA is the teleporter.
The teleporter. I like that.
DOA is the electronic process, the literal digital loading dock, used for depositing or withdrawing securities into a participant's account directly through the transfer agent.
That distinction is paramount for the exam. The questions will try to confuse what these two systems actually accomplish.
Oh, they definitely will.
DRS establishes the legal ownership status. DRS is the movement mechanism. It is the teleporter that moves the asset electronically.
And because we have these teleporters, there's a hard mandate on how broker-dealers settle trades with each other today, right?
Correct. The rule dictates that if a security is depository eligible, any transactions between member broker-dealers must settle via book entry.
Book entry means it's purely a digital ledger update. You cannot send a guy in a courier van across town with a briefcase full of paper certificates to settle a trade with a rival bank.
No, no more 1960s paperwork crisis.
Right. It must be an electronic book entry settlement through a securities depository. It's vastly faster, infinitely safer, and completely eliminates the sewer grate risk.
It is the foundation of modern market efficiency.
Speaking of paper certificates, let's bring in our final character for the final segment.
Yes, let's.
The door to Carl's brokerage bursts open. In walks Frank, the founder.
Ah, Frank.
He took his tech startup public a year ago. He is a massive shareholder, the CEO, an absolute insider. Mm. He slaps a stack of physical stock certificates on Carl's desk and says he wants to sell them today to buy a yacht.
Typical Frank.
But Carl notices something striking. Stamped across the front of these certificates in bold, aggressive red ink is a block of text. Frank has brought in a stock legend.
A restrictive legend is a fascinating legal tool. It acts as a permanent physical warning label on the asset.
I think of the legend as a VIP bouncer. The certificate itself might be 100% genuine. It's not a counterfeit. It's properly signed. But that red stamp restricts the transfer or resale of the stock. It limits what the industry calls negotiability.
Right.
You cannot just take a certificated share with a restrictive legend, hand it to Carl, and say, sell this on the open market to Nervous Nancy. The legal restriction must be formally addressed and cleared before unrestricted resale can occur.
To understand why Frank's shares have a bouncer attached to them, we have to look at two distinct definitions side by side. Restricted securities versus control securities.
Okay, wait. Aren't they the same thing?
No. They are different concepts, though they frequently overlap in people like Frank. Let's define restricted securities first.
Restricted securities is entirely about how you got the stock.
Right. Correct. Restricted securities are acquired directly or indirectly from the issuer or from an affiliate of the issuer in a transaction or a chain of transactions that did not involve a public offering.
So private stuff.
Yeah. If Frank got his shares through a private placement, a Regulation D offering, or as founders sweat equity before the IPO, he acquired them through the private back door. Because they were never registered for public sale with the SEC, they are restricted.
So restricted equals how you acquired it. Now, what are control securities?
Control securities is entirely about who you are.
Who you are. Okay.
These are securities held by an affiliate of the issuer. An affiliate is someone in a position of corporate control. A CEO, a director, a massive 10% shareholder, or a founder like Frank.
Gotcha.
It does not matter how Frank acquired these specific shares. He could have logged into his brokerage account yesterday and bought them on the open public stock exchange, just like Nancy does. But because Frank is an affiliate with insider knowledge, any shares he holds are automatically classified as control securities.
So Frank is holding shares that are both restricted because he acquired them as founder's stock in a private transaction before the IPO and DX. They're control securities because he is currently the CEO of the company.
Exactly. And the SEC is terrified of affiliates like Frank.
Ty.
Because Frank knows exactly what is happening inside the company. If the company is about to go bankrupt, Frank could theoretically use his position to dump millions of unregistered, worthless shares onto the public markets before the news breaks.
Oh, I see.
He would effectively be running a secret, unregulated public offering to save himself while destroying retail investors.
Hence the restrictive legend stopping him from doing exactly that. But Frank isn't a prisoner, right? I mean, he wants his yacht. He is legally allowed to sell his shares eventually.
Yes. The SEC created a safe harbor rule to outline exactly how and when Frank can sell without being deemed an illegal underwriter dumping toxic stock on the public.
This introduces the resale safe harbor holding periods. And listeners, this is prime exam territory, often tested as a matrix. You need to memorize the timeline of how long Frank has to hold the stock before he is legally permitted to sell it.
And the holding period depends entirely on the status of the company issuing the stock.
Let's build the matrix. Condition one. Has Frank's company been subject to the strict reporting requirements of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934 for at least 90 days immediately before the sale?
Basically, are they a public, transparent company, and have they been filing their public financials for at least 3 months so retail investors can see what's going on?
Right. If the answer is yes, the company has been transparently reporting for at least 90 days, then the mandatory holding period for the restricted securities is 6 months.
6 months for a good reporting company.
Right. Condition two. What if the issuer is non-reporting? Maybe it's a completely private company. Or what if they literally just had their IPO and have only been reporting to the SEC for 30 days?
Because there is less public transparency, the SEC demands a longer cooling off period. If the issuer is non-reporting or has been reporting for fewer than 90 days, the holding period doubles. It becomes a full 1 year holding period.
6 months for reporting companies, 1 year for non-reporting or newbies. But when does that clock actually start ticking? Does it start the day Frank verbally says he wants the stock?
The clock is very precise. The holding period generally starts when the securities are acquired from the issuer. But crucially, if Frank purchased the shares, the clock does not start until he has fully paid the purchase price or consideration.
You can't just sign a napkin IOU, hand it to the company, and start your six-month clock. You have to actually hand over the cash and bear the full economic risk of the investment. Acquisition plus full payment equals day one of the holding period.
Precisely. Now we arrive at what is arguably the ultimate exam trap for this entire section regarding restricted stock.
I love a good trap. Listen closely to the setup. Frank's company is a public reporting company. He pays full cash price for his restricted shares. He waits exactly 6 months and 1 day. The holding period is mathematically satisfied. He takes his certificates out of his safe.
Okay.
Here's the question for you. Does the red restrictive legend magically vanish from the certificate? Can he just walk into Carl's office, hand him that piece of paper, and say, execute the trade?
Give them a moment. Think about the mechanics of how paper works.
The answer is an emphatic no.
No. Satisfying the holding period simply makes the safe harbor resale available to Frank. It means the SEC will legally allow him to try and sell them. It does not, by itself, remove the physical restrictive legend stamped on the paper.
Right. There is no magic vanishing ink. You still have to do the paperwork.
Yeah.
Frank has to hire the company's legal counsel to draft an official opinion letter stating that the legal conditions for sale have been met. He takes that letter and the certificate to the transfer agent, and the transfer agent destroys the old certificate and issues a brand new, clean certificate without the red stamp.
Exactly. The restriction must be formally and legally addressed by the transfer agent. Do not assume on the exam that the mere expiration of time equals the automatic removal of the legend. It is a multi-step process.
Okay, my brain is officially full of custody rules, holding periods, and vault mechanics. It is time for the rapid-fire recap.
Let's do it.
Snap back to me. If you only remember six things from this deep dive, before you walk into that testing center and sit down at the computer, it must be these six concepts.
Ready?
Number one, safekeeping versus segregation. Safekeeping is the physical locked vault protecting against theft. Segregation is the legally protected, separate customer compartment protecting Nancy from Carl's bankruptcy creditors.
Number two, loaning fully paid or excess margin securities requires a strict written agreement at or before the loan. Furthermore, the firm must warn the customer in writing that SEPA may not protect them and the collateral provided may be their only source of recovery.
Number three, box counts and the independence rule. You absolutely cannot grade your own homework. The physical count must be made or supervised by individuals whose regular duties give them zero direct responsibility for the securities or the records being audited.
Number four, lost certificates. Whether it is a master criminal stealing the certificate or careless Carl dropping it down a sewer grate, criminal and non-criminal losses both get reported to the exact same entities, the SEC or its designee and the registered transfer agent.
Number five, DRS versus DYC. DRS is the VIP guest list. It is the system that establishes direct registered ownership on the issuer's books. DRS is the teleporter. It is simply the electronic process of moving the shares into the account.
And number six, restricted stock holding periods. 6 months if the issuer has been a reporting company for at least 90 days. 1 year if they have not. And always remember, waiting out the clock does not automatically remove the physical stock legend. The transfer agent must be involved.
Whoa, that is function one in a highly concentrated nutshell. But before we let you get back to your flashcards, our expert has a final, broader thought to leave you with, something to chew on while you review your notes.
Yeah, consider this reality. The entire conceptual framework we just spent all this time discussing, you know, safekeeping, physical possession, locked vaults, endorsing certificates, and physical box counts, all of that was engineered decades ago for a financial world built entirely on heavy paper certificates stored in literal iron vaults.
Right.
But today, we exist in a purely digital book entry reality, and we are rapidly accelerating toward instantaneous tokenized blockchain settlements. So how do you think these ancient, strictly physical definitions of control and segregation actually function behind the scenes when the asset itself is just a decentralized line of code? The physical reality of custody has completely evaporated, yet the legal framework anchoring our entire global financial system remains firmly rooted in the physical realities of the 1930s. It's a fascinating, almost philosophical tension to think about as you study the mechanics of these rules.
The ghosts of paper certificates still run modern Wall Street. I absolutely love that perspective. All right, if you are taking the Series 99 soon, deeply absorb this Function 1 material. Do not skim it. It is the core of the exam. Trust your preparation. Watch out for the gotchas we highlighted. And whatever you do, don't be a careless Carl. Best of luck on the test. You've got this. We'll catch you on the next deep dive.